all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
All right, here we are. We're at the There I Was, sponsored by Veterans Radio, and we want to make sure we thank all of our sponsors, and that would be our local VVA 310, VFW 423, and the American Legion Post 46. We also want to make sure that we thank Legal Help for Veterans and U.S. Wings, the manufacturers of the finest leather jackets in the history of mankind, according to Sergeant Hack, who said that. We're going to be talking today about a memorable experience that we had when we were in the service, whether it was overseas, as I mentioned before, or we were stationed at home, wherever we happened to be, because there were many memorable experiences for all of us while we were in the service, and this is just going to be one of them. So starting off tonight is Scott Brooks Miller, United States Marine, and Scott, you are on.
Hi. Memorable experiences. I had many, many memorable experiences during my 5 years in the Marine Corps. But I have to tell you that my most honorable experience was being selected to be a Marine security guard while I was in Vietnam. An S2 officer came down and talked to me for a long time. Actually, he came up. They were down in Quang Tri and we weren't. Talked to me a long time, and then he finally said, would you be interested in serving as a Marine security guard with the State Department? So, you know, being 18 years old from Central Illinois, I said, oh, golly, yes. And he said, well, you'd have to extend 1 year. Oh, that's okay. So, you know, I gave him my verbal approval, and he goes, well, we have to do, you know, there's a lot of paperwork. So I signed a release for a security background check. I had to have a top secret clearance. This was all approved before I left Vietnam, all within, you know, 45 days. Came home, did my 20 days home on leave. One of the stipulations was that during my 2 year term as a Marine security guard, I could not be married. Of course, I had my little high school girlfriend, and so I came back, we can't get married. And anyway, that relationship ended. Actually, it didn't end right away, but that was the beginning of the end. So I head off to Washington, D.C. to it was in Arlington, Virginia, Henderson Hall, right next door to headquarters of Marine Corps. Right next to Arlington National Cemetery, and did 6 weeks on security and etiquette. And it was very, very interesting. Marine security guards are outfitted by Brooks Brothers, and we were forced to, we had like a $1,500 clothing allowance, and with a Marine senior staff NCO, we went to Brooks Brothers. We were fitted. We were not allowed to buy anything that was shiny or reflective. Or, you know, this is all pre-disco, remember? You know, it was basically the same kind of clothes that I'd gone to high school in. You know, cool selection of ties and, you know, three suits and five sport coats and five or six pair of slacks. And so we go through school, and at the end of school, the last week, we get our orders to which embassies we're being assigned. And I'm being assigned to the American Embassy in Vientiane, Laos. And I said, you know, I said, there's no way I'm going back to Southeast Asia. And I still feel that way today. But I just cannot go back. And they said, well, you know, you extended a year. We'll send you down to Camp Lejeune. And you'll have to fulfill the 3 years or the almost 2 years and 9 months. And I said, you know, I don't care. I cannot go back to Southeast Asia. He says, well, you'd only be there a year, and then you'd get a good duty station. And I said, I'm not going back to Southeast Asia. And, you know, and these are officers, you know, and I'm a E5, not even 5-6 months. And it's really hard, you know, when you're 19 years old, to look at majors and colonels and say no. And so this major goes, I want you to go over to the cemetery and take a walk and come back here tomorrow morning and give us your answer. And so I did. You know, there's a place right there behind Henderson Hall where the wall's only probably 3.5 feet. You sit down, flip your legs over, and, you know, we'll go walking through the cemetery. Great place. It was my first introduction to meditation, you know, walking around and thinking about a problem. And I did that. When I came back, you know, an hour, hour and a half later, still the same answer. And so I went in the next morning at 10 a.m., and said, I cannot go back to Southeast Asia. And he goes, okay, well, we'll prepare your orders to go to Camp Lejeune. And I was sad, but so be it. About 2 or 3 days later, I was approached about, how would you like to be attached to the State Department in downtown Washington? Oh, make me suffer. They had a group, and there were never more than five of us that we were called Special Security Detachment to the State Department. Our admin officer was a major, and the battalion commander was a brigadier general. For 2 years, I lived in Washington. My primary job was taking the families of visiting foreign dignitaries on tours of Washington. There were four occasions that the security component came in, and I had to travel overseas because there had been violations reported, not by the Marine Corps, and every embassy has a staff NCO in charge of an embassy, and then however many enlisted or E5s and below at that embassy. Like the biggest one was in Saigon. That was Company E. That was 250 Marines at the American Embassy in Saigon. Vientiane, Laos had a staff of 12. I was not going back to Southeast Asia. Make a long story short, I spent 2 years wearing civilian clothes, occasionally in uniform, giving tours, and on four occasions I traveled overseas, once to Lima, Peru, to bring back a Marine who had impregnated a foreign national and wanted to marry her, which was not allowed, and so his term as a Marine security guard ended. Once to Khartoum, Sudan, for a Marine who would talk too much, basically. You know, just he'd be jabbering with people out on the street. The Marines were not restricted to the embassy. So, you know, we brought him back to Tel Aviv, Israel, where a young Marine was dating and this kid was like no older than me, 19, and he had fallen head over heels for a young Israeli girl about the same age. They met on the beach. They're sneaking around. Of course, you know, it's hard to sneak around when you're attached to an embassy and you've got a dozen or so CIA people snooping and pooping all the time. So brought him back. And then my favorite was New Delhi, India, where this Marine Corps sergeant was dating a Russian national. And we brought him back in handcuffs. And he did go to Leavenworth. So, you know, you weren't allowed. The American embassies, and according to the instructors at the Marine Security Guard School, were staffed with young women for the Marines' convenience. And I apologize for putting it in that way, but that's the way it was presented to us. And, you know, there's really no need to. It was just forbidden to date foreign nationals. But so it was a great 2 years. When my 2 years was up, I transferred back to the track vehicle school at Camp Pendleton, finished out my last year, got in a bunch of trouble. You know, going from civilian clothes and having lunch, you know, with majors and above and, you know, foreign service officers and that kind of staff, it makes it hard to go back to a track vehicle school in the bureaucracy of the Marine Corps. And when I was in Washington, I got involved in the anti-war movement, and joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and that followed me. So there were uncomfortable times in California. Got out, went to college. GI Bill afforded me many opportunities, and I took advantage of them all. That was it.
All right, so next on my list, we're moving along here on There I Was, presented by Veterans Radio, as our November program, and I've got Brian Graff up next. Brian was in the service in 1968 to 70, and he was in the Army, and he got all the way up to Spec 5. All right.
You know, memorable experiences, I know all of us can close our eyes and probably come up with a dozen of them, right? Not all of them good. But if you know me, I like to keep things on the lighter side. So this is what I would call probably my modern-day Private Ryan experience. I was out in the field. I think it was Fire Support Base Keene, and this chopper came out and landed just outside the base camp, and these two guys jump off the chopper, and they're running into the base camp, and they're running right at me. Okay, I'm going home. And this one guy says, come with me. Why? I didn't explain anything. They just took me and put me on this helicopter, and we were gone. You You know, you can't talk very well on a helicopter, right? I mean, they are pretty noisy. So I'm trying to get an explanation, you know, am I going home or where am I going, you know, what did I do? I got back to a stand-down area, and this Colonel Anderson came up in front of me. I understand you play guitar. Well, how would he know that? Yeah, I could play guitar. Go over there and talk to this Filipino group. I said, what do you want me to do? What? Well, the lead guitar of this Filipino group that was supposed to entertain the troops, and there were several hundred troops there on stand down, the lead guitar got sick and never made the trip. Well, you know how to play guitar. We want you to get up there and play guitar with these guys. You got to be kidding me. And I got up there, and I'm talking to all these Filipinos up there, and the lead guy couldn't be more than 4'11", maybe 4'10", something like that. And believe it or not, he could play two trumpets at one time, as I saw it. I said, what are we going to play, guys? What do you know? And I quote, the little guy says, Beach Boy, California Girl. I go, no, we're not playing the Beach Boys. I wasn't a fan of the Beach Boys to begin with. And so I think the first song we did play that actually turned out pretty good was Chicago. Does anybody really know what time it is? And, of course, the whole group said, yeah, it's time to go home. And they kept shouting that every time we sang that song. And so we were talking, okay, what are we going to play next? Well, believe it or not, what was the big group in the 60s? The Beatles. I knew every Beatle tune written. Right behind the Beach Boys, yes. And these guys knew every Beatle tune, too. I mean, we brought the house down. It was just phenomenal. This colonel afterwards said, you got to go some more, you got to do some more entertaining. And I had no idea how. He was trying to get my MOS changed, I believe, to 42R, which is a musician, not a magician. And so I got two other guys that I knew real well. If you're out there in the radio land, Bob Norton from Syracuse, New York. Doug Smith from Petoskey, Michigan, and two nurses that I have no idea what their names are, we formed a jug band, and we played jug band music, and entertained in Cameron Bay. We were supposed to go to Da Nang. Never happened, never got my MOS changed. They sent me back out in the field. But on my first R&R that I went to, I ran into Colonel Anderson again, and he said called me up one day. He says, I know you love music. If you really like music, you need to get over to the Hong Kong Hilton because Ann Margaret's in town and she has a dress rehearsal at 1 o'clock that day. I said, you got to be kidding me. So the guy that I met in Hong Kong, Terry Poole, just a crazy chopper pilot, he and I went over to the island, snuck in a back door of the ballroom, and there she was up there doing a dress rehearsal. I said, hey, let's go see her. No, we're going to get caught. I went up and had coffee with her for about 45 minutes, and I know you're not going to believe that, but I brought pictures tonight so you could see them if you're interested. Talked to her about 45 minutes. It was her first trip to Hong Kong. Invited to the dress rehearsal afterwards, or the cast party, and it was a lot of fun. Again, that was my lighter side. Things that are going on in Hong Kong today, if you pray what's going on in Hong Kong today, because they're destroying that city. It's unbelievable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brian. I would encourage everybody who's here for our open mic night to go over and look at his album, because Ann Margaret is as beautiful then as she is now. And he's got some nice close-up shots. I'm sure he would be more than happy to autograph them and copy them and give them to you for a small fee. Moving right along as we go continue. Let me see what we've got going here. Keep these going. These are great stories. Sandy Wilson is up next. Sandy is a nurse in Vietnam. She was a lieutenant colonel. We have to stand up for this, I think. She was there. She was in the service from 67 to 94. So, Sandy Wilson, come on down.
Well, you know, I think I had a lot of memorable things, but I'm not sure. I remember I was down in Texas. And two things were quite memorable to us. They took us out to Camp Bullis. I thought I was going to sit in this class in air conditioning in August to learn how to be a field nurse, and this was after I'd gone to Vietnam. Man, I looked forward to that. I'm just going to sit there in that air conditioning, and they're going to teach me everything I already know. Well, when I got there, I got to sit in that air-conditioned classroom for an hour during the 10 days that I was there. So then they take us out to this Camp Bullis, and it's the first time in my life I've ever seen men and women pitch a tent, and they give you the cot, and it was man, woman, man, woman, man, woman. This is sort of strange. So I started looking at all the stuff I'm going to do, and the thing, you know, we're going to rappel down the side of a hill and jump out of a helicopter, and I'm thinking, And then, and it was also the first time I've ever seen a water buffalo come up and it be filled with ice. Maybe they've changed things in the Army, I said. I don't remember ever getting ice before, but I kept thinking about the things that we were going to do. Well, I'm trying to think of what is a rope bridge, you know, and I spent some time living in the South. And I know they used to have these rope bridges to where you had the sides were ropes that you hung on to, and the boards were tied with ropes when you walked on them. They told me that wasn't it. So then I thought about, well, maybe this is going to be like where those people go flying on the TV ads down this rope that's attached to it, you know, zip cords or something like that. I thought maybe that was a rope bridge. So we got up one morning, and they took us on the side of the water, up on this rock, and I saw this one rope. And I went, nah, they're not really going to have me do this. So I'm sitting back dreading that I'm going to try and do this. And then when the fourth guy went over, I got this brainstorm. I figured that when I got attached to this rope, there would be no problem going halfway. But then you got to crawl up the other side. And the guy ahead of me was a radio man with a radio on, and he was about 6 foot something and weighed probably 250 pounds. And his back pockets got kind of damp as he went down this rope. And I'm thinking, yeah, you can go down, but how in the hell are you going to get up the other side? And all the women in the class are still sitting there on this rock. And I said, oh, nah. I got to have some guy behind me to push me up the other side if I can't make it. So I quickly went, and I did, you know, I made myself up the other side. All of the women followed me in a big hurry. And I said to them later that day, I says, why did you all follow me? And they says, we didn't know why you went then, but we knew whatever you thought about, it was a good idea to do whatever you wanted to do. And I said, well, I wanted some guy to push me up the hill. And they said, we knew it was a good idea. Okay? Then they had us rappelling and jumping out of a helicopter. But the funniest was they took us out for the night navigation with a compass and all that stuff. My team was the first one in, like hours ahead of everybody else. Because before, when I was at that place during basic, my team lost the compass and we had to pay for it, okay? So when they took us off the truck, I says, anybody here good with a compass? And this guy, oh, I'm so good at it. I says, fine. This is the instruction, shoot me the azimuth. And he did, and there was this huge thicket. And I said, give me the map. You know how we got to the end, don't you? I did a lot of ducking when I saw lights, but we sat in that truck for 3 hours before anybody else got in. But things like that I thought were sort of strange and all that sort of stuff. But the end of it, I really liked. It was 115 degrees, and they decided we were going to do the PT test, and we had to run 4 miles. But it was a one-mile square. And I knew all the people doing the documentation. Well, you know, they had people out measuring how far out you had to go. And every time I came around, I would say to them, they told me to tell you you're a little bit far, you got to move in more. That was the first thing. When I made that third trip around and I knew I was going to fail, one of those scorekeepers said, you know, you did a really good job. I don't think you've ever completed your 4 miles this quickly. What do you think I did? I laid right there on the ground because I knew I was done. And when the rest of them went out for beer, I was up in my room laying down in front of the air conditioner. But, you know, those are sort of, I thought it was a very nice course. The only problem is they were placing bets on who was going to go down with heat stroke first. And there were a lot of people that had their money on me. Well, there was this other nurse that outranked me from Minneapolis. And I looked at it and thought, well, she's about 8 years older than I am. And it's colder in Minneapolis than it is in Michigan. So maybe I got a chance. And then I went and talked to her. Every day for 2 months, she'd been going out on her lunch hour and jogging. And when she told me that, I knew I was screwed. Well, you know, we did have one of the people did suffer a heat stroke. It was a lieutenant who had been assigned in Puerto Rico. And I think he was probably 20 years old. And I was laughing so hard I couldn't assist him. They had to walk around me and take care of him. But I thought that was a pretty memorable thing. After that, I learned to read all the instructions before I agreed to go someplace.
It's always kind of interesting when if you read the instructions, things always seem to be much easier. But, okay, that was great. Thank you, Sandy. Sandy Wilson was a nurse in Vietnam with many other interesting stories. Are you ready? Oh, okay. Well, evidently, Larry wants to go next. So we are going to have Larry St. Antoine, who was a Navy Seabee in Vietnam. And he was over there, seemed like forever. Many tours. Come on, you're French.
Many tours. Anyway, I had two real kind of experiences I want to cover. As I said, I joined the Navy Seabee Reserves in 1964 when I was a junior in high school. And being in the reserves, I brought a Naval Armory downtown Detroit. You did your meetings, and then you did 2 weeks somewhere, wherever they sent you. Well, they sent me in that year at Peaceful Valley, Colorado. The Boy Scouts were having their jamboree, and the Seabees were building the camp for them. So all the Seabee reserve units all over the country were going there for 2 weeks at a time. I'd never been in the airplane. My dad takes me down to the airport in Detroit. And we have Flying Tigers Airlines. You know, it's a prop plane, you know, first plane ride. So I'm sitting on the window side with one of the guys next to me. And we're about halfway to Colorado. And I look out the window and I said, what's that running down the wing? And he looks over and he says, I think that's oil. I says, it's supposed to be running down the wing. He says, well, that's not what bothers me so much. He says, I think there's some rivets missing from the wing. And so I look over there, and you count like every fourth or fifth rivet is not there. We land in Peaceful Valley, Colorado, luckily, and they condemn the plane. And so we're up in our greens. You know, of course, you're up in the mountains. And the third day there, we get 5.5 feet of snow, colder than heck. But to end it, we got to fly back commercial. So that was pretty good. The other experience I had was after my first tour in Vietnam in 1967, we came back to Port Hueneme, California to be refitted for our 3 months back in the States. It happened to be the 25th anniversary of the Seabees that started in 1942. So they were having some kind of soiree in downtown Los Angeles at some fancy hotel for us. They put us on a bus. We got down to the hotel. We went into the main room where they had all the fancy people come and sing and stuff like that. All the free drinks you wanted. You couldn't see the tabletops. And I'm not, it wasn't just beer. Any drink you wanted. Our table was so full, and there was nothing drank yet. We just kept putting it on the table, and we knew we'd get to it eventually. After about an hour, my two buddies and I, we decided to go to the head. And we're walking down one of the aisleways to go to the head, and we see these two guys coming toward us. And as they kept getting closer and closer, they're getting taller and taller. I'm going, what in the hell? And he says, what are you doing, pilgrims? It's John and David Wayne. You know, he had done John Wayne in the Fighting Seabees for World War II, and he was there to he sponsored this for us. And we didn't know it. So we went to the head, and we came back, and we walked back into the room, and there's Donna Douglas. taking pictures with everybody. Oh, Ellie Mae Clampett, you know. That was the most fun we ever had because within a week later, instead of 3 months at home, we spent 2 weeks. They called us up for Tet. We didn't get to do our 3 months at home, so it was only 2 weeks. But it was a great experience. Got to meet John Wayne and David Wayne, salt of the earth, greatest guy in the world. I think he was getting ready. They were talking about the Green Berets, John Wayne and the Green Berets back then. And he also said, I'm going to make sure the Seabees are in that too. He says, I love the Seabees. And they were. That's my story.
Thank you very much. John Wayne, Anne Margaret, Donna Douglas. Holy smoke. We can meet all these famous people going along the ring. All right. As we continue on this evening, we've got John Kinzinger. And John was in the service from 66 through 68 in the Army in Vietnam. And he graduated as a Spec 4. Come on down, John.
Fought hard to become a Spec 4. I've been listening to the humorous stories, and I've been trying to think about something that I could talk about, but I don't remember any humorous times in the military, to tell you the truth, other than the little poking around that you do with buddies or like brothers. Well, I was 19 and a half when I was drafted. Hadn't traveled much anywhere. I did my AAT, and I was supposed to be a teletype operator in a signal company in Saigon. Got to the 98th replacement, and they told me otherwise. I did remember the 1st Cavalry Division. It must have been Idrang Valley or something. It was always on the news at night. And this 6E7 there at the 98th replacement said, all of the following, fall out over here for the 1st Cavalry Division. And they called my name. And I was like, must be a mistake. Well, they needed radio operators. That was my basic MOS. So off I went. I was assigned headquarters company, 2nd Battalion, 7th, 1st Cavalry Division. John Wayne, which we just mentioned, you know, was a hero of mine. The Sands of Iwo Jima and all the rest of them. And I thought I was doing some John Wayne stuff, going over and fighting for our country. And I never saw real combat. I don't want to lead you into anything like that. But my job was to fly out with the grunts, set up my radio on the LZ, and they'd go off and say, Charlie. Soon after, one of my first missions with them. You know, they flew in. They had secured this perimeter whenever I landed. Troll went out. I'm still trying to figure out what the hell I'm doing here. They had been gone for about 10 minutes and they were ambushed by a VC. That's all we saw in our province was VC. Firefight didn't last very long. A little while later, here's our guys, Americans, bringing this black pajama, obviously an enemy. I think, well, we always set our radios up in the highest point in the LZ because that's what we were there for. So I go down to where the these guys have this black pajama person, and I'm going to see my first enemy. I got two medics working on this guy. Been zipped across the stomach. I looked down. I was like a 10-year-old kid. And I had an altogether different feeling about what I'm doing over here because this was not the enemy that John Wayne would have been fighting. So the whole psychological thing, you know, went through me for the rest of my tour there. I called medevac, and we brought a chopper out, and I don't know if the kid survived or not, but we actually, we were not baby killers. We were trying to save this kid. Then there were times where, I remember one time we were going in, and the chopper wouldn't land. So I've got this big antenna bag. I got my Prick 25 on my back. Of course, I got my weapon, my grenades, and, you know, the real soldier kind of stuff. I jump out of the helicopter and I'm right into a rice paddy. I don't know how much extra weight I had on me, but here I am, you know, up to my waist in crap. Made my way out of that. Fortunately, it was not a hot LZ or anything, but I'll never forget my first time in a rice paddy. Just, it was a tour that had its ups and downs, and, you know, I made some great friends over there, some I still visit with today. We had some good times, you know, we had... There were times when we'd have a mascot in the unit where it might be a monkey or a dog or something. And I always tell the story of when we had this monkey, if we'd get a beer, we'd share the beer with the monkey, and then the monkey would mimic us, smoke a cigarette. We'd give him a cigarette, he'd act like he's smoking a cigarette, and he'd give him a little more beer. And some of the stupid stuff that we did over there, you know, pouring lighter fluid on big scorpions just to see how long they'd last. You know, it was memorable moments. R&R, Singapore, that was memorable. I can't go into any details there for obvious reasons. Coming home was something else. That was memorable. My mother knew I was going to be coming home sometime. I was the oldest of five, so I was the baby in the family. And I didn't realize how much she worried about me. But I was able to come home with a taxi cab over in Belleville and surprised her. And what a pleased expression there was. That was very memorable. And I think just meeting all you guys has been memorable. That's my story.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Moving right along here. We have a relatively younger person now. We got Kate Melchers here. Kate was in the Army for 8 years, and she was an Apache pilot. She left the service as a captain. My goodness, we got all these senior officers here now. So we'll find out what was one of Kate's most memorable experiences.
When I saw the social media post about this event and what the topic was going to be, I had a list of about 100 different things that I could talk about. But almost without fail, when I have a speaking engagement, something happens the night before or the morning of that completely changes what I wanted to say. Today was not an exception. There are many memorable moments, but the most memorable part of service was the men and women with whom I served. I've been thinking a lot as I've been coming to these events about how interesting it is that even though our service was 50 years apart, I can sit down and have a conversation with a Vietnam vet and the language is the same. We had similar experiences in basic training. You know, we can laugh at the same jokes because the language hasn't changed that much. But this morning reminded me of one of the things that makes our service very different. So with the exception of Colonel Wilson, most folks in here were drafted or volunteered for a single enlistment. In my generation, there was no draft. Every single one of us volunteered, and most of us, especially in aviation, planned to spend a career serving. So when I talk with Dale about what his flight training was like, his flight training was over in the blink of an eye. And for me, flight training was a full 2 years. So between basic training, for some people that went to walk school, for me that went to OCS, through our flight training, it was years of time together with the same men and women before any of us ever got our first duty assignment. So family is created in a number of ways. Some of you became brothers when you were in a foxhole or in a trench someplace. My military family was brought up slowly and deliberately with a lot of sibling rivalry. Army aviation is a pretty small community. You might not know everybody, but you know somebody who knows everybody. So this morning when I woke up and I saw an initial report of a Chinook being downed in Afghanistan, panic set in immediately. Because one of my favorite people in the world who used to fly Apaches is now flying Chinooks and he's downrange. And I'm scrolling through to see if I can verify this story, and there's nothing else about a Chinook, but there's another article from Military Times that says that an aircraft went down in Afghanistan and two American service members were killed. That only happens in a 64. This can't be a Chinook. All right, so Eric's okay. Then starts the worldwide roll call. The texts go out. The searching on the computer, the internet is an absolutely wonderful thing. But my panic has sort of ebbed and flowed throughout today, trying to figure out, all right, which units are downrange? Who's flying where? All right, I heard from John today. That's good. All right, Derek, heard from him today. Good. Gail's doing great. Who haven't we heard from? You all know the rules that the Army's not going to release the names of those pilots that were killed this morning until 24 hours after their families have been notified. Without fail, the community identifies them before that public announcement comes. But as I'm sitting here with you, I still don't have the names. There's still some guys that I haven't heard from. I'm pretty sure I know what unit it is, but guys, PCS, I don't always keep track of them as much as I wish I should. And days like today, I feel like I should be a lot better at it. There is something absolutely gut-wrenching about sitting here, knowing that we're still at war, but sometimes forgetting. Sometimes forgetting because I've got to get in the shower and get out the door and do whatever it is I have to do today. And it's looking at Facebook at 7 in the morning that slaps you back into reality. I had absolutely no intention of bringing the room down. I had every intention of telling you all the ways that we almost died in flight, because that's pretty fun and pretty memorable, because we survived. But this morning absolutely changed my day. And outside of being there with them, I can't think of a better place to be than here with you guys tonight, because I know you get it. Thanks.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you very much. This is one of the things that we wanted to do with this whole program of There I Was, is we create a safe environment where people can come and tell their stories, funny or sad, things that get on our chests that we have to get off. So I appreciate, Kate, I appreciate your honesty, and I'm so happy that you felt safe enough that you could tell us about that. It's a small community that we're part of. All of you here were part of this community of people who were willing to pay the ultimate price, and there, people are still paying the ultimate price. And so we have to rally around that concept, the idea that we can help each other. All right, so we're moving right along now. We've got Don Veeam. It's your turn. Don was in Vietnam in 1968-69, and it says here that he got out as a sergeant. Holy smoke.
Rank was pretty easy to come by in the infantry. You just had to survive long enough, and it came around. It was no big deal. Kate just changed everything I was going to say, because I'm going to talk about something that I want to be on a record because it's so seldom talked about. I was a radio operator over there. For 10 months, I was in the, what they call a company, CP, forward observer, whatever. But for that 10 months, I was with a South Vietnamese interpreter named San. San and I lived together. We fought together. We ate together. I knew he had 7 brothers and sisters. I knew their names. I never met any of his family. And on April 30th, 1975, we abandoned him. I never heard up until recently. I've talked to some, as you know, I've worked with the National Guard and a lot of veterans there, about relationships that they formed with people from the country we were in. And you know, I feel the same way about him as I did us. And I thought about going back to Vietnam. I hesitated because I thought, what would happen if he's still alive and I ran across him? What would I say? How would I explain it? What would I do? Now, here's a person I lived with for 10 months, and I lived with him actually longer than I did with a lot of gentlemen in my unit, because he rotated in and out, you know, 3, 4, 5 months. And that, I never addressed that, and that was part of the reason I went back to Vietnam, to see what had happened, because I know he probably went to a re-education camp. You know his family was punished, probably could never get a job, anything above a beggar. I wonder what happened to him. I wonder what happened to the family. And I just feel I want that to be on a record, because this is a part I think a lot of people don't talk about and don't address. But when I worked with the National Guard guys, I found a lot of them the same way. They were on guard duty with Iraqis. They formed relationships and bonded with these guys too. And we don't address that. So that was one of the things that struck me when I was here tonight, that I feel safe to say now. I got some time left. I'd like to present another little story. A lot of my memories came from senior NCOs, and I think that started out with the drill instructors, you know. So I used to wonder, what happened to drill instructors? When I got to NAM, I found out they became first sergeants. So you think about it. These guys, in my particular case, most of them were from Korea in the infantry, volunteered at age 35 or 40 to come out in the field and be with us. So, you know, they couldn't have been wrapped too tight. But they did wonders, because the tensions that built up in us young guys, we knew we had some place to let it off. So we were in a relatively secure daytime situation. We only worked at night, basically. And it was the first sergeant, myself, and signed a couple other people. And for some reason, the first sergeant, I was left alone. I'd been there about 4 months, and I'd figured out we weren't going to win this war. I'd listened to the insanity on the radio, the stupid decisions that come down, the dumb stuff that was done. And I don't know what triggered me. I went off. I mean, I started swearing and cussing and jumping up and down. And this wasn't too uncommon, and you just accommodated it because everybody was, you know, you could have your day. And I, Sergeant Broly, Korean War veteran, tougher nails, I go into this frenzy, and he stops, and he sits down, sits on a log, kicks back, lights a cigarette, and I'm still just boiling. Finally, I was exhausted, you know. And he sits there smoking that cigarette, and he gets a little grin on his face, and he says, "Don, everything you said is true, but this is the only goddamn war we got. I had nothing." And I'll never forget that day.
Thank you, Don. Kind of try to make it on a little bit of a lighter side. I guess I think I'd better tell a story here. And I guess it'd be one of my memorable moments. And as Kate was talking the helicopter stuff, I was sitting here going, okay, what stupid thing did I do that was really weird? And I was wondering about that psychological test that they gave us, you know, when we took this. Oh, you'd be good for doing that. But, you know, we've talked about, you know, the basic training flight school and all the other things. And so I was just imagining something, a most memorable thing. We did a lot of work with the Royal Thai Army in Bearcat. In Vietnam, and one of the things that we did is that we would always go out carrying the Thai generals or colonels and whatever it would be to look at their various fire bases that were set up around the area. And this one day, we were out there. I think I was a brand new aircraft commander, so it's my airplane now, aircraft. And so we are sitting down in this LZ, and we started hearing this pop, 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 you know, the firing and stuff. And I, you know, we look around and the door gunner says, "Somebody's shooting at us." You know, he says, "We're taking fire at 9 o'clock and stuff." And so we jumped up, you know, everybody jumped back on the aircraft and we took off. And this guy comes out of the tree line on a bicycle and he starts racing down the road on a bicycle. And a general in the back, he says, "Let's get him, get him." And this is how dumb I was. I said, "Okay, so I'm flying down this road at about, you know, 4 feet off the ground, trying to catch a guy on a bicycle, and he's he's pedaling as fast as he can go, and I'm saying, well, what do you want me to do with him? Do you want to shoot him? Do you want me?" He says, "No, knock him off the bike." I knock him off the bike. All right, so I go, I fly up next to him, and the guy could have had grenades, everything else all over him, you know. I fly up next to him and nudge him with the skid. And off he goes, and he gets, you know, rolls in the dirt and comes up and jumps in, runs into the village, and I follow him into the village, you know. And I see him going to this hooch, and he says, "Get him, get him, get him." And meanwhile, we dropped off some other Thai guys, and he says, "Get him out of there." And I'm going, all right. So I just came to a hover over the top of the hooch, and the roof blew off. The walls went down, and there's the guy in the corner. Somehow, thank God, he lost his weapon somewhere along the line, and he looked up at us, and I can see his face and everything else, and he just went like that. And so that is probably one of the dumbest things I ever did, but also quite memorable. And you know, dealing with the enemy was something that was, you know, we didn't get a lot of face time with the enemy, thank God. Unfortunately, you guys were out there doing all that stuff. We did pick up one time. The other quick story is this. We picked up some VC suspects. And, they, you know, they put the band around their eyes and all this stuff. And the interpreter was yelling at him to get information on him. And they put him on the aircraft, and they say, "Take them up." And I say, "Okay, take them up." And then he kind of whispers to me through the intercom, and he goes, "But only go to 3 feet. Act like you're taking off." And so I go, you know, and I just kind of settle back down on the ground. And I'm moving around, you know, doing this stuff. But I'm only 3 feet off the ground. And you can see him yelling at the guy in the back. And he's going, like this. And the co-pilot's going, what is he saying? I don't know what they're doing. A door gunner's going, he's grabbing the guy by the snap. You know, he's grabbed him by his shirt. And he said something to him about, if you don't talk, boom, boom. And he took the guy and he threw him out the door. 3 feet, right? The other guy wouldn't shut up. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to that one, too. That one, too. Second time we go to the Air Force, I should have the microphone turned up there. That helps. Come on down, Vance. Vance was in the United States Air Force, 1963. We were all but mere children then, 63 to 67. I was going to say 67. I was a sophomore in high school.
Thank you for referring to me as an old fart. You know, what's really cool about this program that Dale has put on for us, I was a nephew of Uncle Sam for 4 years in the United States Air Force. And I retired after 4 years in the United States Air Force. Being in the Air Force, you're in a different bubble than the Marines' bubble and the Army's bubble and the Navy's bubble. Even though I was in Vietnam and next to the Marines, we still didn't experience the day-to-day life that those guys did. And it wasn't until I became a member of this chapter and started associating with the other veterans, from Brian being a guitar player, dragged out of the field to entertain the troops. Dale's story just now about flying 3 feet off the ground and they kicked that guy out to get the other one to talk. This is stuff that I thoroughly enjoy, and it helps me as a veteran. And listening to Kate talk about it and her training experiences and how she expressed herself tonight. And Larry talking about that big long snake that some guy come out of the bunker with that's in the book that we have published. Memorable experiences. After being in the Air Force for 4 years, there's lots. There's lots of different experiences that always stick to my mind, and majority of them are a lot of fun and happy. I think the first one that comes to my mind is standing in the room with maybe a couple hundred other guys with my whitey tighties down around my ankles. Some little guy sitting on the bench in front of me or on a stool with his little finger up next to the boy saying, turn my head and cough. I raised my right hand to do this. You know, it was a little strange for me, you know. And then being hustled into a bus and taken out to Detroit Metro Airport and put on an airplane. Now, all of us in the bus were Air Force folks, but in that big auditorium, for lack of a better word, there was a mixture of service members in there. And they put us on a plane. We went to Chicago, and it was in January 1963, and the plane got snowed in, and there were no flights coming in and out of Chicago, so they threw us on a train to take us to Texas, San Antonio, Texas. Going to school at Lincoln High School, which is just up the road a piece, we didn't have any racial issues. We had very few blacks in our school, but we didn't have any racial issues. And that's where I experienced looking out the window of the train as you look down the tracks and you could see the other trains in front of you wobbling back and forth. And we come into these little communities where they would stop and pick up mail and passengers. And there's these drinking fountains that says blacks and whites, restrooms that says blacks and whites. That's my first experience of racism as a white person, you know, witnessing it like that. Didn't witness it in the service because they all treated us like crap. Getting to Lackland Air Force Base at the getting off the train, and they put us on another bus, big old blue bus, Air Force blue colors, and they hustled us out to stand in this great big huge field that was nothing but concrete with footprints painted in the cement. And I'm giggling to myself and smiling as the drill instructors are having us line up, and I got caught doing that. And I suddenly learned what colorful language is, because the Crayola crayons that I used to use as a young kid didn't have that kind of color in them. He got in my face and just ripped into me upside down and one side down and the other. The next experience or memory is my first night. We woke up after our first night in the barracks, two-story barracks. I was assigned a top cot, top bed on the bunk bed. And the same drill instructor coming down the hallway or down the bay of the barracks with an empty trash can and something large in his hand, ringing it like this, waking everybody up. Grab your blank and your socks and fall out of bed. You got 3 minutes to get out and line up in formation. Forgetting that I was on the second bunk, I came down on top of the guy who was getting out of the bunk underneath me. And guess who's standing right there? That drill instructor. He got to know me, and I got to know him real well. Going through basic training in Air Police School and then Sentry Dog School at Lackland Air Force Base, I was there 6 months and was assigned to an Altus Air Force Base, which was a strategic air command base in Oklahoma. B-52 aircrafts and ICBM missiles surrounding the 40-mile radius around the air base, which were being phased out when I got there. And I had my second dog, Dutch, the dog I took to Vietnam, and we were in the kennel section, kennel area, where we would work our basic obedience, and they had an obstacle course, and the area was all fenced in. And if you run your dog on the off-leash, you're supposed to, there can't be anybody else in the area, because at that time, sentry dogs are trained to be very aggressive and would attack anything that wiggled, sometimes including their handlers. And there was a guy running his dog on leash on the obstacle course, and my back is to the obstacle course, and Dutch is sitting in front of me, and you hear the command, loose dog, which is what we're supposed to holler when you see or your dog gets loose to alert everybody. And so I stepped to get out of the way because my dog seen it, and they met between my legs and just growled, snarled, barking, and having a good old-fashioned dog fight. We got our dogs separated and put them in our kennels, in the dog's kennels. And I come out, and my crotch and my pants, my fatigues, are all red. So Sergeant Collier come out, our kennel master, and he saw the blood on my crotch. I said, "Sergeant, go get your gun, put me out." He done ripped my stuff off. I mean, it's it, you know. Yeah, he says, "McCrum, pull your fatigue pants down." I said, "Can't do it, sir." So he ripped them apart and pulled them down, and it got me on the thigh. Is what was had been bitten, and then I had a huge sigh of relief that I would be able to have children sometime in my life. One of the things that, while I was in Vietnam, that made my backside tighten up so much I couldn't have passed a grape seed was my dog had alerted on a visual alert. It wasn't a scent alert, and it wasn't a sound alert. And I could see it was alert like he has never alerted before. And it says, "Uh-oh, I'm in deep doo-doo. It's just me and my dog out there." You know. And it, as it was, what it turned out to be is the area that I was patrolling was an area that the Air Force and the Marines and the Navy put their aircraft, typically helicopters, that were shot up and unrepairable, and so they were used for parts. And there was a report that there was some activity there around dusk, so they sent me in there with my dog, and that's what I thought I'd seen was a whole herd of Viet Cong coming after me. But as it turned out, it was a horse. And it must have been your captain from the Marines, because it was a Marine captain who brought this horse in from the Philippines, and I don't know how he managed to get it to Da Nang Air Base. But it was gone shortly after that. I think coming home from Vietnam, I came home early. The war protests weren't on yet. It was in the news, but it wasn't like it started to be in late 66, 67, and 68, when most of you guys were in country at that time. And the war protest hadn't gone on. My parents never discussed Vietnam with me, and that hurt. It's not that I wanted to talk to them about it, but I wanted them to understand what I felt like and what it was an experience for me, even though it wasn't like the Marines and the Army experiences, guys, that you had in Vietnam. And that bothered me and still does today. You know, since that time, and of course they're both gone, No. My dad didn't serve. He allegedly had a ruptured eardrum, so he couldn't get into World War II. Decades later, Dutch. I'm always thinking about Dutch, and I had found out through a combination of people at work when I was working at the time and through the dog handlers, Vietnam Dog Handlers Association, and I was able to contact his last handler, the guy I trained to Dutch before I left country. You know what happened to him? I knew he didn't come home because we knew when we went over that the dogs were going to stay. You know, there was 4,234 dogs used in Vietnam, and a couple hundred were killed in combat, which is a testament to the skill of the dogs and their ability to alert the handler to what's going on in their area. But Dutch had apparently contacted some disease that was, you know, 15, 20 letters long, you know, and I found out about that. And I cried, and that was in the 90s when I heard that, you know, that I knew he wasn't alive. You know, I knew that he was dead. And I think today, something that I will always, always, always remember was my association with Chuck Kettles. John and I and our wives were invited to Washington to witness the Medal of Honor ceremony. But it was more of an honor. And plus, we got to go to the Pentagon as well to see that ceremony. But it was more of an honor to be asked by Chuck to witness it versus actually seeing it. Because that, it's right up there with my marriage and the birth of our children, you know, and grandchildren. It's something I'll never ever forget. And those of us who spent some time with him over the vast few months of his life feel the same way. That's it.
That's the end of another There I Was for November. And, stick around. Make sure you find out. We're going to be at the Ann Arbor VA on December 18th. I'm not sure of the time yet, but we're going to be talking about some of our experiences with holidays, of course, while we're there. So thank you all very much for being here tonight, and you are dismissed.